All right, everybody. Good afternoon, good evening, Free Assange. Good to see you. I know I think my guests today and I are going to completely agree on this. I think we come from different political backgrounds, but I listened to him on the Revolutionary Blackout Network with a couple of other guests that I've had on the show, and he was just incredibly smart, and I really admired his knowledge about China because this is one of the topics that interests me the most in regards to foreign policy, living as like an anti-interventionist libertarian here in the United States. So I won't keep you guys too long here. Make sure you hit all the links below to figure out where you can find my guest, myself, Tiger Fitness through the link below to get your supplements, get yourself all jacked and tan. I need to restock. I'm almost out of protein powder. Fox and Sons Coffee, use code Kyle at checkout and deemed fit to get some clothes that make you look even better when you're jacked and tan. So, without further ado, let's talk about China and BRICS and some other stuff, mostly projections of the empire, which I think is gonna be an accurate name for the show today. All right, guys.
Get your exterior painting to-dos done easily with Dutch Boy Pristine Exterior Paint. With its rain-rinse technology, rain naturally washes away dirt and grime. Plus, it resists cracking and peeling, making it perfect to withstand the harshest weather conditions. Save big money on Pristine Exterior Paint and start your painting project today. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
All right, and welcoming to the show, my newfound friend, Q Anthony Lee. How you doing, man?
Good. Doing great, bro. First of all, I gotta say, because I was gonna comment on your guitars, and I was like, wait a second, this dude is like, he is your aesthetic is speaking to me right now. I saw the guitars in the background. Is one of those a Strat?
No, so they're all Jericho. Okay.
Okay. I couldn't see them too well, but yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I got a Paul Reed Smith. Three Jerichos, two Hard Luck Kings, a Harley Benton, a Diamond, one custom built one, and a Wild Audio. And
man, you're living the life that I want to live. Yeah, and then I saw your supplements in the background and shit too. I was like, oh my God, I've just found a new best friend.
Well, beautiful, man. Well, you know what? We're no, both
we're gonna be lifting buddies one day. Don't worry.
Oh, dude, please, 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 please. So, you know what? Before we start,
go ahead.
No. Well, I was just gonna let you kind of run the floor with an introduction, but what were you gonna say, real quick?
No, I was gonna say that I don't know if you knew that I had a pretty catastrophic injury. Like, I had a bad accident back in July.
Yeah, I remember hearing you talk about that recently.
Yeah, I had to go through three knee surgeries, like bilateral knee surgery. Yeah. So I basically had to like have my knees rebuilt. I'm recovering fairly quickly though, because I've got about one of them I can actually like tuck back under my thigh now. So I can actually like bend it right back under my hamstring.
Yeah.
Which, like, you know, for having been operated on July, like, you know, even my surgeon was saying, I've never seen somebody recover that fast.
Oh, dude, that's awesome.
Yeah, and then my left leg, which had two surgeries on it, to repair the patellar tendon and part of the ACL.
Yeah.
That one I've got about 130 degree range of motion, so now I can actually like do pistol squats. I can't do like ass to grass squats anymore, but I can do workouts. Mm-hmm. But once I was able to like get out of the hospital bed, I was like working out immediately,
mm-hmm.
and now so like. I've actually just topped 250 pounds for the first time in, it's been years since I was the heaviest I've ever been was about 270, but yeah. I was fat. Now I'm 250. I mean, I'm fatter than I would like to be. I've got a higher body fat percentage than I'd like to be. It's in the 20s. Now I don't necessarily like that, but I was just like bulking up over the winter time. I'll get shredded next year. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like I was bench pressing. You know, I was doing pike push ups and all kinds of shit that I could do with my upper body. Doing it, you know, tricep dips, kickbacks, like pretty much everything that I could to get my upper body in better shape than it was than when I had the accident in the first place. And now I can probably say that I'm looking like my upper body is looking better than before the accident.
Dude, that's awesome. I'm stoked for you, dude. That's really, really cool. Yeah. I, my record deadlift is 545 Bench press, I got the 305, and squat, I got the 400 at about 210 pounds.
Yeah, that's good. How tall are you?
5'11".
Okay, yeah, I'm 6'3".
Okay, so. Holy shit.
Yeah, so my lips are going to be, obviously, you know, because I'm a bit taller, my lips are going to be a bit higher, but
yeah,
I will say squats are the one thing that are challenging for me because all of my height is in my legs. They're so far to travel, yeah.
Yeah, oh man, yeah. So, you know, as soon as you start getting down into the hole, I usually know if I'm doing like a little bit more volume as soon as I start going up in the weight. So when I go down, I'm like, oh boy, am I coming back up? I don't know. Yeah.
I know. When you get to the bottom, you're like, hey, bro, I might have to bail. You know, yeah. I know. Yeah, luckily, that has not happened to me in my entire life. Like, I haven't had to just like bail backwards on the weight so far. But I've had a few lifts. Like when I get into the 500-pound range with the squats, versus like, holy shit, I don't know if I'm gonna make it. And there's, I have a home gym, right?
Oh, nice.
And I'll usually work out by myself, so it's like, hey, yo, like if no one's around,
you're fucked. Like,
yeah, somebody might come home and find me folded up like a pestle underneath these weights. Yeah.
Did you see that video? I forget the bodybuilder. He was an Asian bodybuilder from somewhere. He was squatting, I want to say it was 400 pounds, and he was in like a power rack or anything like that. And he tried to roll the weight over his head.
No.
Killed him.
Are you serious? Killed him.
Yeah. Fucking killed
him. He rolled it forward?
Yeah, it went over his neck and he killed himself like that.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, no, you gotta bail backwards. Absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah, dude. I mean, the barbell going off your back. Worst comes worse, you break a barbell, but I mean, it's better than breaking your neck.
Yeah, exactly. That's what happened to that dude, too. Much better than, exactly. The paramedics coming and finding you looking like you just died in a Saw movie.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah, Jesus. Yeah, dude, I can already tell we could talk lifting all night, but why don't you give the audience an introduction to you and kind of what you talk about, because I never heard you talk about lifting. I love this conversation, but I wanted to talk to you about China. Dude, I can already tell we're gonna do more conversations.
yeah. No, I mean, I'm happy to come by wherever, but so my name is Q Anthony Ali. I previously worked with all kinds of publications in the West. So McLean's Magazine, I assume that you're not in Canada. So McLean's Magazine, it's a national magazine in Canada, basically like the Canadian version of the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. You know, we have two of the Atlantics. There's like, there's McLean's and there's the Walrus. So I was a contributing editor for McLean's, wrote for the Globe and Mail, which is like, you know, daily newspaper. It's pretty much like the Washington Post up here. Mm-hmm. I have written for the Washington Post as well, written for Vice, written for American Prospect, Guardian, etc. And I'll say that I haven't been told by any of these publications that, like, hey, we're not going to accept your pitches, but I pretty much stopped sending out pitches once the Russian invasion of Ukraine happened, the special operation in Ukraine.
Yeah.
That's when I stopped sending out pitches, because the week prior to that, I had actually sent out a pitch. I'm not going to say which publication it was. But I sent out a pitch to a publication that I've been writing with for a very long time. And it was concerning the Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, Chrystia Freeland. Mm-hmm. And Chrystia Freeland, you might have heard about her. She has her grandfather was a Nazi collaborator in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm.
He ran a publication called Krakowski Vesti. And it was actually seized from a Jewish owner. So there was a previous publication owned by a Jewish family, and her grandfather, during the crackdown and eventual like Holocaust against Jews in Poland, seized the publication and started cranking out a pro-Nazi press organ.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people said that, well, she can't really choose her family, that's not her fault, which I can partially agree with. I can partially agree with that. You can't choose your family. However, Chrystia Freeland was raised in a very far right. And when I say far right, I'm not talking about like right wing, like don't come for my guns. You know, I don't want to pay heavy taxes. Yeah. That. I'm talking about like fascistic elements. And, you know, she was raised in a highly fascistic Ukrainian community. When I say that they were Nazis and Nazi collaborators, I mean, they would actually check, the government of Canada would check for Waffen SS tattoos on Ukrainian immigrants to approve them for entry to Canada. Those were the ones that they wanted.
Yeah. What
they were trying to do was to crack down on Ukrainian labor organizing in the prairies in Canada. So I pretty much like put together well-sourced and unimpeachable evidence that this lady was raised within, worked alongside these types of Ukrainians in Canada. Mm-hmm. And also that publication that she wrote for was an incredibly anti-Semitic publication. I mean, there's just no way that she wouldn't have known about some of the articles that they were writing.
Yeah.
Either minimizing or denying outright the Holocaust. And I was told by this publication that I had written for over 4 years, no, we're not going to run that because we're afraid of getting sued. And that, for me, I was like, okay, so this is where the whole House of Cards falls down. Once you actually criticize a beloved liberal in this country, once you come for them, that's it. They don't want to hear from you. So that was it for me in mainstream pubs. I said, well, I'd rather just take a little bit of time off, you know, lick my wounds and get back to writing and speaking, in the sense that I can actually say what I actually believe and not have to water down or mellow out my points of view so as not to offend liberals, and talk about geopolitics in the way that it actually exists and not the way that we wish it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dude, I got you. That's all really good stuff. It says my connection's kind of going in and out, so hopefully it's not too bad. But I feel much like you in that respect, as in, like, I don't want to be held down by anybody. And we were talking off air about how I was canceled, quote unquote, or basically denied a job because of my political beliefs. But, yeah. You know, I see other people who were kind of acting one way in private and then speaking and talking another way in public. I'm like, man, that's never been me. You know, I want to be able to say what I want to say when I want to say it. It would be so much more profitable for me right now to come out and say, I support Trump. You know, I morally support Israel, and, you know, we need to fight a war against China because that's the talking point on the American right today. But I'm not going to do that. I'm still, I would like to believe, mostly like socially right, but I'm still as anti-interventionist as it gets. Like the Ron Paul libertarian legacy, that's kind of like my North Star, so to speak. So, like I said, it'd be hugely beneficial if I did that, but that's not what I believe. And, you know, to me, it'd be crazy that people feel like they have to like shift their beliefs to placate other people. Like, I've never had that bone in my body. It sounds like you don't either.
No, I have. I know exactly what that feels like. I could make a killing if I'd have just stayed. Because, you know, when I did enter into political writing in Canada,
yeah,
I was a fairly bog standard liberal, maybe like a progressive liberal, but still liberal nonetheless. And I could have made a lengthy career. I could have been, you know, I could have had basically like Jamel Bowie's career in Canada if I'd have stuck with that. But once you begin to learn a little bit too much, I have a problem. I've just got a big fucking mouth.
I know the feeling.
Yeah. Right? I can't say something other than what I actually believe. I don't have it in me to talk bullshit. If I don't know about it, I will just not talk about it.
Yeah.
I'll make mistakes just like anybody else, but unless I feel comfortable and well acquainted enough with the topic, I'm not going to talk about it. And I felt like there was a huge push for me to start talking about things, especially like the way races lived, etc. And some of that stuff, I'm just like, I don't really want to talk about that. That's just not my cup. I'm not a sociologist. It's not my cup of tea.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is, if I don't believe something, if I have beliefs that are diametrically opposed to what it is that I'm expected to say, I'm just going to tell the truth. Yeah. And unfortunately, like that just doesn't go very far in mainstream media. So I'm not going to be one of those people who's like, well, you know, I was canceled for telling the truth. If anything, I would say that I kind of removed myself and took a little bit of time to reevaluate how I want to present myself, what I want to talk about, how I'm going to present these facts. And I'm starting to get back into it now, especially with the encouragement of Nick and Zoya from Revolutionary Blackout Network. They really have been encouraging me to come out of my shell, because they know that I'm a student of history, and that all I love to do is take a topic that's germane to current affairs and current discussions, go deep into the history about it. I'll basically like retreat into the Batcave, like you see it right behind me here. go deep into the history and then come back with an informed point of view on a particular topic. Mm-hmm. And it kind of frightens me that that's just not something that people normally do.
Right. So one thing,
and I'm not talking about regular people. I'm talking about people like in the press. You would be surprised how fucking stupid most people are that work in mainstream press.
Yeah. Yeah. I have the conversation with one of my buddies, Red Hawk, about this. If people in the government are malevolent or if they're just dumb. And it seems like there's probably some malevolent people higher up in power, but when you kind of look at like the ground level, I refuse to believe that these people are completely evil. I think a lot of them are just opportunistic and retarded, if I'm being completely honest. I mean, that's just the way it looks to me. If you've been to a DMV, you know, like a driver's license center anywhere, you'll understand exactly what I'm talking about.
No, I used to live in West Palm Beach, Florida. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I used to live in West Palm Beach, Florida, actually. So I know exactly what that's like.
Oh, yeah, dude. It's absolutely terrible. So one thing that I'm kind of curious about that I heard you talk about that really kind of drew me to you was stuff about China. So I know that Canada runs military drills with the U.S. sometimes over in like the Taiwan Strait. And, you know, obviously they do a little bit of saber rattling too, but U.S. is kind of like the big one. What is kind of like the position that you kind of had of China beforehand? Because I think like most Western standard programming is that China sends us cheap junk that breaks. And then now, obviously, over the last 10 years, it's been, oh, China's this great global threat. They're going to take over the world and they're going to push out America. And they're the biggest threat in the world. And we need to be absolutely terrified of China. Did you have that same impression? And if not, what was it? And where are you now?
I will tell you that I remember how I just said a little while ago, if I don't know about a topic, I will just generally shut up about it.
Sure.
And that's how I was where it related to China. I kind of bought into the bog standard narrative that China is basically like the world's factory. Mm-hmm. That's where all of the cheap labor that we don't want to do, we just send it over to China, and then they send us a bunch of junk products, and they also pillage our intellectual properties, copyrights, etc. Mm-hmm. So the only way that they're managing to get ahead is by just copying what we're doing, but doing it better.
And using slave labor, using Uyghurs.
Yeah, exactly. That they use Uyghur slaves. I really hope that whatever algorithm is being used to filter out hate speech is not catching me the wrong way when I say Uyghur. It caught my interest because my background my educational background is in international relations. I joke about this. I'm the only international relations grad that didn't turn out to be a complete fucking parasite, like a total vampire. Normally, you should not trust international relations grads, but
yeah.
The standard narrative that I had heard was what you'd mentioned before, but something caught my attention in the mid 2000s, and that was I believe it was 2007. There were knife attacks that happened in the capital of Xinjiang, the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region, which is one of the provinces of China, in far western China, bordering Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, etc. There were knife attacks that were happening there, and it caught my interest because the U.S. and China were working together for a few years prior to that on stopping the growth of terror cells in Central and Western Asia. So there was this movement. You've probably heard about Wahhabism, right?
Yeah.
This like extremist sect. I don't even like to call it an extremist sect of Islam because there's nothing I recognize that is Islamic about it at all. It was actually a sect put together by a cult leader who was funded by the British in the 18th century.
Okay.
Now, the people who follow this cult belief are responsible for what we would now call, let's say, like modern day terrorism. So like Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc. They follow Wahhabist beliefs. The same thing was happening in Central and Western Asia because that ideology had been spreading northward and eastward out of Pakistan and Afghanistan. So I mean, as somebody who's like super interested in international relations, I thought, oh, that's pretty interesting. I never realized that China was going to have to end up being a partner in the war on terror also. Let's look more into this. Then in 2009, there were riots in the capital city of Xinjiang, which was it's called Urumqi. So there are two major cities in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. There's Urumqi and Kashgar. So there was a major riot in Urumqi, and part of that was due to the fact that young men in that region didn't have good prospects in life at all. Mm-hmm. it was economically stagnant. It was at the effect of nature. So earthquakes, floods, etc., would just batter the region. There really was no manufacturing in that area, so to speak. Not the way that you'd see in like Hebei, Guangzhou, Shanghai, etc., or Shenzhen. Like none of that had actually reached to Xinjiang. Even though, you know how there's special economic zones in China,
mm-hmm.
where Western companies can actually do business. So Xinjiang actually has its own special economic zone, but there was just no manufacturing happening out there, so no work was being done. So, you know, I mean, that happens. This has happened in countries like Sweden. It's happened in Italy, where you have young men that are, I mean, in those Western countries, it's primarily immigrants. They move there with the hope of a better life, but because the economy is so stagnant, there's just nothing that they can do. And they oftentimes they will fall into extremist beliefs because at least somebody is speaking to them. Yeah. And for a long time, the United States and China, I would say for roughly about 10 to 11 years, the U.S. and China were working hand in hand to combat terror and terror ideologies. But right around 2012, 2013, things flip. So this is after the midterm during the first Obama administration,
mm-hmm.
where Senator Marco Rubio gets elected. That was in 2011. He took office.
Yeah, and one other thing, I'm sorry to interrupt, but that was also after Obama had announced with Hillary Clinton the pivot to Asia, which was 2011.
Yep. That's right, 2011. That's right.
Yep.
And here's what they were trying to do. And I hope I'm not like rambling too long. I don't want to.
No. Please expand as much as you want.
Okay, so do you remember in the year 2000, there was the U.S.-China Relations Act? Do you remember that?
No.
Okay, so this was what was supposed to be his lasting legacy.
Mm-hmm.
What Bill Clinton wanted to do was to this was actually sort of this was a blowback against Clinton having been snubbed by Hu Jintao prior to that, where the United States wanted to not only expand the special economic zones. What they wanted to do essentially was to create free trade in the region. So just like every other country that the United States essentially dumps its low productivity capital into and then hollows the country out. You think of, for example, like, you know, banana republics. Think of like Honduras, Ecuador, what they attempted to do in Nicaragua, etc. They find these regions where people are willing to do menial work at a much lower wage than in the United States. And then they dump all of their manufacturing there, but as they also dump excess consumer goods into the region, mm-hmm. and it depresses the job market. It depresses wages. I think Haiti is probably the best example of how the United States does that. So if you order like a T-shirt from Amazon, the T-shirts are made by a company called Gildan, G-I-L-D-I-N, Gildan.
Oh yeah,
and. Yeah, and Gildan is, yeah, they're made in Haiti because the wage is artificially depressed there. And that's what previous presidents and administrations, ever since the ouster I was about to say Papa Doc Duvalier, Jesus Christ. No, ever since the ouster of Jean-Bertrand Aristide in Haiti, Haiti has essentially been just a low-cost factory for the United States. And they were attempting to do the same thing in China. China absolutely refused to expand the special economic zones. What they said was, mm-hmm. sure, we'll absolutely work with you, but we have intentions of industrializing our own economy.
Right.
And then so the 2000 U.S.-China Relations Act, it was a double-edged sword. What it did was allow China to become a full member of the World Trade Organization, but it also had provisions regarding labor standards, human rights laws, etc., and also to stop Chinese goods from being dumped into the U.S. market. So normally the U.S. dumps its inexpensive goods after they've been highly marked up, their excess capital they dump into other countries. What they're afraid of is a reverse dumping of inexpensive manufactured Chinese goods into the United States. The legacy of that is why, for example, you can't get Chinese electric cars imported to the United States without insanely high tariffs on them. Right. So whereas it began with, we want to make sure that your employees receive a fair hearing if they decide that they want to get higher wages, benefits, etc., that you're not working them to death. This was after like the Black Brick Kiln Factory expose, where it turns out that people that were working at this cement and brick making shop were essentially slave labor, and some of them had actually like died and been burned to death on the job. And there was an attempted cover up. We don't want those kinds of conditions if you're able to become a full member of the World Trade Organization.
Right.
But what that did was open the door for the United States to continuously hammer down on China and say, you're not actually meeting what we believe to be fair labor practices. You're not living up to your human rights obligations. So where does Xinjiang and the U.S.-China Relations Act of 2000 converge? Well, what happens is the United States in 2005, I think I read, was when I saw the first white paper that talked about the possibility of religious extremism in the Xinjiang region because people simply don't have jobs there, their prospects are terrible, and they're falling into possible religious extremism. And that could actually cause ethnic separatism because the Turkic Chinese, and there's a long history of Turkic Chinese people, the Uyghurs, you could almost argue that they are Turkic in nature. Many of them would say that they are primarily Turkish over Chinese. But there was a possibility that they would actually attempt to balkanize, to break away from China altogether and form their own country. As a matter of fact, there's a movement for that, which has been around for years, called the East Turkestan Independence Movement, which up until the Trump administration had been classified as a terror organization. So after these white papers would come out, and after the knife attacks in 2007, and then the riots in 2009, China heavily cracked down on religious extremism in the region. But they also did one thing that the United States suggested, and which was a very good idea, because not only the United States, but human rights organizations have been saying this to China as well. You need to find some way to incorporate Uyghur people into your labor supply. If they can't get jobs, this is the direction that they're going to go. So you are falling short of the promises that you made in the year 2000. So you need to do something to make sure that they are integrated both into your economy and into your society broadly.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So this is kind of where I'm guessing the Falun Gong and kind of like the whole idea of Uyghurs being forced into camps kind of started. Am I getting that correctly?
Falun Gong is different. So Falun Gong is actually this.
I know that's like a chi energy cult or something like that.
Yeah,
it's super wild.
Yeah, they're people that long for the return of the Qing Dynasty. Is what they are.
Right.
Yeah. So they believe that the Chinese Revolution was an utter catastrophe. That it upset the natural order of things.
Yeah.
I think they were trying to say that like Manchurians were being oppressed or something like that. I don't know if you've ever been to like the Shen Yun concerts. Have you ever been to one of those?
No, I've never left.
Are they advertised in your city? Okay.
No.
Okay. Yeah. Shen Yun is an annual event in Toronto, and it's put on by Falun Gong, and it basically is just like this interpretive dance. It's like a musical about how like communist China is evil, and we need to return to like the historical China. But it's so farcical. It's almost like, have you ever seen or heard of the Book of Mormon by Matt Stone and Trey Parker? Did you ever see it?
No, I never saw the movie, but I know loosely about it. Mormonism is like one of those things that I heard about a lot, and I didn't know what it was like.
Exactly. The Book of Mormon, the play by the creators of South Park.
Okay, no, I'm sorry.
Okay, no, I saw it when it was here in Toronto, and it was absolutely hilarious. But it's basically just like a very comical look at Mormonism, and Shen Yun is almost like this incredibly comical look at the history of China, except they're dead ass serious about it. Right.
Okay.
So, but the Falun Gong are some really weird people. Like they believe first of all, they think that interracial marriage is like a blight against God, that each race was created like separately by some other. Like so like divine beings created some races, but then like demonic beings created other races. They run this insane fascist publication called the Epoch Times.
Yeah, the Epoch Times, and they get funding from the CIA through the National.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they're okay, but they will oftentimes join hands with Uyghur people that say that they're in exile, but really they're, you know, and they're not even really refugees. They're just people who fucking left. But this so-called persecuted minority of Uyghurs will often join hands with Falun Gong for the purpose of attacking the Chinese government. But the Falun Gong are mostly like religious, and it's not just religion. It's also like monarchist extremism in one direction. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Uyghur World Uyghur Congress, the ETIM, etc., they're religious fundamentalists and hyper nationalists. So the founder of one of the co-founders of the World Uyghur Congress, Erkin Alptekin, his father was actually a fascist that allied with Chiang Kai-shek. Mm. During, so you know when there was a battle between the communists and Chiang Kai-shek's army as to whether China was going to become a republic or a communist state, and the Republic of China ends up retreating to what is modern-day Taiwan. Well, right. So Isa Alptekin actually allied with Chiang Kai-shek until Chiang Kai-shek has lost that war. Mm. He ends up fleeing with millions of dollars in gold bullion on a CIA jet, lives in Taiwan for a number of years, and then migrates out to Munich, Germany, which is why the headquarters for the World Uyghur Congress is in Munich, Germany.
Yeah. Wasn't Adrian Zenz from there as well? Like he was kind of around Germany, and he was the one that published the paper claiming that there was a Uyghur genocide through it was a numerical error on the amount of IEDs inserted, something like that.
IEDs, yeah. So that's also like the most interesting definition of genocide that I'd ever seen. The UN Convention on Genocide doesn't mention anything about, well, if there was no such thing as birth control, X amount of children would have been born, therefore a genocide is happening. Well, normally, like, not even Christian extremists in the West will touch that one.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because it almost reminds me of how people say, oh, Biden and Trump gave, Biden gave so much money to Iran. But usually, like, when you look into it, it's like, oh, no, this is just potential money they could get from sanctions relief. Yeah. And then most of the time, Biden never even let off the sanctions anyways.
He's been as hard as Trump has been on sanctions. He's actually increased sanctions to several countries, primarily, or at least most notably in Cuba. You probably heard about the Cuban power plant going offline, which ended up cutting power to most of the island. Mm-hmm. And yeah, part of the reason that they cannot maintain a steady power grid is because of the crippling sanctions that Biden has increased in his administration. Yeah. You know. So anyway, I just to tie this all back to the original topic. So where we are on that is that the United States is essentially trying to create ethnic separatism in China by removing Uyghur people from the labor supply chain. Mm-hmm. So previously it was, you need to integrate these people into your economy, because if you don't, you're going to have a terror problem on your hands. China listens to this advice. They crack down on ideological extremism on one hand, and I will even say I will think, and this, I'm somebody who's like G-pilled, right? I will say I think the Chinese government went too far in many respects.
Yeah,
I don't think that a genocide is happening, but I think that there were some rather draconian measures that were taken, having, for example, like administrators go and live inside the homes of Uyghur people. But hey, you know what? This is not something that I necessarily have to deal with, so it's not for me to say. But people act as if you say that there's no such thing as an Uyghur genocide, you're denying that there haven't been any sort of human rights violations, or that the Chinese government has done nothing wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm not willing to say that. Every government does something wrong. I mean, I live in Canada. My government is doing wrong every day by allowing the genocide in Gaza to continue.
Right.
But I don't live under the conditions of any Uyghur person. I don't live in the conditions of China, which is under constant attack by Western countries.
Right.
So who am I to really say anything? But I will say, though, so they did two things. They cracked down on religious extremism, but they also offered an out for people. They offered a relief valve, which was the desert in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region as one of the largest silica deposits in the known world. So what are the required components for building solar panels? Is quartz and silica.
Mm.
If you have massive deposits of quartz and silica, and you have this gigantic potential workforce, what do you then do? You train them so that they can work in solar panel factories. And that's why China's massive explosion in solar power over the past 8, 9, 10 years, one of the reasons that the United States fears them is because China is moving itself towards a post-carbon and post-industrial economy. And in many respects, they are becoming a post-industrial economy. Chinese consumers don't necessarily consume what is made within the country. They'll consume from what's made outside the country, and their surplus capital leaves the country, not as finished products for Americans to buy because they were made in Chinese shop or Chinese factories. But the factories are even being migrated outside of the country. So there are factories that were formerly in China, or factories for companies that formerly existed in China, that are now being moved out to Taiwan, to Vietnam, etc. So China is, in many respects, catapulting itself ahead of many Western countries, including the United States, and they're bringing Uyghur people along for the ride. And what solar power is allowing them to do is move themselves off of carbon. What they're also doing with their Belt and Road Initiative, in cooperating with other countries in the global south, is enabling other countries to do essentially what they've done, to create a massive trading block among the global south that doesn't need Western permission to exist. So, for example, I just said to you that the Xinjiang Autonomous Region has a massive deposit, or massive deposits of silica and quartz. In Africa, which many people, like, well, not many people, pretty much everybody would agree that Africa is underdeveloped and was deliberately underdeveloped by Europeans. Did you know that Africa passed a free trade agreement a couple of years ago that includes every single country except Mauritius? Did you know that?
Mm-mm.
Africa actually has, I think, the key to the future in its hands, and China is helping them get there, along with Russia, along with India, because both Russia and India's their export-import banks are offering low-interest loans to African countries to help them industrialize. But here's exactly how that's working out. 90% of all railway infrastructure on the African continent exists in South Africa. The remainder of the railway infrastructure on the African continent is very haphazard, but it mostly leaves from agricultural areas and from city capitals out to ports. Why? Because all that Africa has ever been good for, as far as Europe and the West is concerned, is to rob them of their natural resources and export them elsewhere to be manufactured into finished products. And then after those finished products have been made at an extreme markup, and oftentimes they're like defective products or surplus products, they're then sold back to Africans, right? So, for example, all the coltan that is mined out of Congo, out of Central African Republic, etc. Where are their iPhone factories? Where are their Android phone factories? They don't have them. The cobalt is pulled up out of the ground and then shipped elsewhere as a primary product to then be turned into, or to be incorporated into silicone boards, and then manufactured into phones in some other country. And then at the end of the process, after we've eaten our fill, we've bought all the phones that we want to buy, all the surplus products are then shipped back to Africa. So the question is, okay, but why can't they just make their own phones? Because they don't have the ability to move those goods from one area of the continent to another area of the continent. So what's China doing with regards, for example, with Ethiopia, and to some extent Somalia, but Ethiopia and Eritrea have massive deposits of limestone. What limestone is necessary for is to build, or is to make concrete.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have limestone and gypsum and the ability to make concrete, but you don't have the ability to move those products to other areas in the region, well, China will come in and say, well, you actually hold the key to African development in your hands. If you want to build railroads, if you want to build roads, or pretty much anything, if you want to build buildings, you need concrete. We will not only give you low interest loans to help you move concrete to other African countries. We will also train the engineers that will pull up out of the ground. We'll even train the train conductors that once we're able to build, or once we're able to build railroads with the financing that we gave you, you'll have train conductors that can move them, move the goods from one area of Africa to the other. That's what the Belt and Road Initiative is all about. This scares the shit out of the West, scares the shit out of the United States, because what's happening is that global South countries, countries that used to be underneath the thumb of the West, are now industrializing and creating this massive economy, this massive future and forward-looking economy without the permission or even the involvement of the United States. All of the potential profits there are not being captured by the United States. Mm-hmm. That scares them. And that's why they have to continuously shout about this Uyghur genocide, because two things. If you stop Uyghur people from participating in the supply chain by saying, well, if a product was made in this region, you have to show us that that labor exploitation did not happen along the way. How the fuck can you prove a negative? All right. Like, how are you supposed to prove that? Okay, according to what metrics here exactly, right? Mm-hmm. Are they being forced to work those factories? No, they're being paid to work there. Are they being forcibly moved out of their home region to go to another region to work in the factories? That's what Adrian Dens says is happening. Mm-hmm. That's what the Australian Strategic Policy Institute is saying. This institute, by the way, which is funded by the defense industry, that's mm-hmm. That's what human rights NGOs are saying. I don't know if you know about the province of Alberta in Canada, and that's basically like our Texas. That's where primarily most of our oil comes from is out of Alberta. When there was an oil boom in Alberta in the early to mid 2000s, people moved from all across Canada to go to Alberta to work in the oil industry, right? They worked the oil sands. They made a whole bunch of money. They could settle down there. They could, for the first time, if you were like, if you're a city slicker from like Toronto, you don't have a chance of buying a house in Toronto, but you could certainly move to Alberta, work the oil sands there, have a home, a pickup truck, meet somebody, settle down, have a family. You can actually do that. That's the exact same thing that's happening in Xinjiang, except that rather than on a carbon-based industry, they're now doing this with solar power. People are like moving in droves to where the factories are so that they can work, settle down, have families, send money back home. And what the United States is saying is that, well, they're doing that because they're being forced to. And they're like, no, we're doing that because we want to. That's that's where the money is. And on top of that, when they say that China is, for example, colonizing Africa, what they're saying is the money that China is using, or that they're lending these countries at low interest and forgivable loans, by the way, mm-hmm. that they are doing the exact same thing that the United States and that the West have done, which is absolute bullshit, because China does not require what are called structural adjustments in exchange for their loans. Structural adjustment might mean something like this. Yeah, sure, Zambia, we're going to give you a loan from the IMF, but you're going to have to privatize your healthcare industry. You're going to have to deregulate your broadcast industry. Your public broadcasters, well, they're going to be sold off to private companies. If you do that, then yeah, sure, we'll go ahead and give you the loan. Now, as a libertarian, you might say, well, that's a great thing, but
my pushback there, which, you know, typically I would be for privatization, but if you look at the situation in Argentina where we have a self-proclaimed anarcho-capitalist elected president, if you hollow out your industry and then just allow NGOs to come in and then basically, you know, swoop up in that vacuum, that's a problem because you're no longer privatizing to like people like you and me. Right. When I think, me and kind of the libertarian sphere that I run in, when we think privatized, it's like, hey, you know, basically free trade amongst you and your friends. Right. Like, you know, if you need a service, you pay this person for that. If you need, you know, stitches or something from a doctor, you pay that doctor right away rather than an insurance company. Or if you have insurance, then like it's all basically deregulated. So that way there's no government interference and people basically can set their own rates individually rather than a government or an NGO coming in and doing that. Or if like it's a small company.
You're like an anarcho-libertarian then.
Yes. Well, I consider myself like a very limited government libertarian, but pretty much.
Right. In the sense that, you're preventing large and monopolistic companies from swooping into the vacuum and replacing the government where there's, all you've done is basically hand over that monopolistic entity from public hands to private hands, where there's even less accountability to the people. And I can completely understand that point of view. Like, I have my, like, you know, my concerns or whatever with it, but we're kind of on the same page.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what's happening here, is that China is affording low interest loans to these African countries, which I said are forgivable. If they run into economic trouble down the road, they can always restructure the loans and refinance them. As a matter of fact, many countries during COVID, I forget how many hundreds of or how many tens of billions of dollars were refinanced during COVID, but that's what China offered to many. I know that Zambia was offered that. They refused, and then they elected an anti-Chinese president, which then put them in an even worse position. Ghana was afforded that. Somalia and many other countries that had these loans from China were able to refinance at oftentimes 0%. Like, there was no penalty for refinancing them, right? So, but what China wants to be able to do is create its own trading partners, and it's up to these countries individually to set the terms. So there have been examples where, in Zambia, one of the reasons that they had anti-Chinese sentiment was because the managers of the mines. So Zambia has the largest deposits of copper in Africa, possibly the world. But that's why they used to actually be the richest country in Africa, was because of their massive copper deposits. It's also the reason why, for example, during the mid to late 70s, you know how there's a lot of houses that have aluminum wiring?
Yeah.
Ever wonder why that is?
It's probably because it was cheaper than copper.
No, well, for a specific reason. It's because of the Iran oil embargo. So the Iran oil embargo, because most of the copper that was being consumed in the United States for home wiring and for plumbing came from Zambia.
Mm-hmm.
And because oil had skyrocketed in terms of price, the ability for Zambia to export its copper goods to the United States for manufacture into copper wiring and copper tubes to make plumbing pipes. Well, that was severely impacted. So what the Boulder economy in the U.S. did was substitute aluminum instead. And if you have a house that has aluminum wiring, a lot of electricians will say to you, well, if you can, rip out the wiring, because there are some properties with aluminum that are not good and can be potentially fire hazards.
Yeah, aluminum's a lot weaker than most other metals. It's not as conductive. It can corrode a lot easier, whereas copper's a lot more durable.
Right. And very importantly, it shrinks in the wintertime.
Right.
And it expands in the summer. So what'll happen is, you know how, like, when you wire up a socket, like an electrical socket or a light socket, it's basically just the wire becomes a hook, and then you screw down the hook into the socket. Okay. So what'll happen in the summertime is that it'll expand and start to push the screw out, but in the wintertime it'll then shrink. And then when you have a gap of air between the screw and the wire, it will then arc.
Right.
The electricity arcs, and that can become a fire hazard. And the reason that happened was because of the Iran oil embargo, and also because the IMF absolutely destroyed the Zambian economy in the 70s and 80s. Yeah, that's the reason why. And China comes in and says, okay, well, hey, you know what? We will refinance, but hey, we'd like to go ahead and buy up your copper mines. And the government of Zambia says, okay, sure, yeah, come on in and buy up our copper mines. I mean, they needed the money. I'm not saying this was good. Actually, in many ways, it turned out to be disastrous. Because the mining managers, who were Chinese speaking, didn't speak the Zambian language, didn't really know the people. I mean, granted, like, a lot of people in Zambia speak English, but there was a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier, there was labor exploitation, and, like, oftentimes literal physical abuse of mining workers. So when Hakainde Hichilema gets elected, I believe this was in 2021 or 2022, when he gets elected on his anti-China platform, he then turns to the IMF and says, okay, well, we've got this onerous debt that we have no idea what to do with here. Can you please help us out? IMF says, yeah, sure, but you're going to have to do further deregulation. So that is to say, what happened to Zambia is what the United States and the West want to happen to China. And what China is doing is it giving many of these countries that would have never been able to industrialize on their own the ability to do that. But the weak point along this chain is the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region. Why? Because that's where high-speed rail and natural gas pipelines will also go through. So the natural gas, which is underneath the ground in the XUAR, and high-speed rail, which will be able to transport goods into the global south, into Central and South Asia, into the African continent and to have goods coming back from there, they're essentially building a new Silk Road, and the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region is almost the linchpin in that. As far as their entry into that, like that's like the westernmost point in China. And what the United States wants to do is foment separatism, wants to foment Balkanism and extremism. Oh, that's why they take the East Turkestan and independence movement off the terror list, because if you break China at Xinjiang, then you disrupt their ability to build that new Silk Road, to build
Holy
the
Belt and Road Initiative. Crap.
Yeah.
I had I always knew that was like a deal. Like Mike Pompeo had talked about this. Joe Biden called it a genocide. Ron DeSantis, pretty much all like the big names had talked about it. I had no idea that was why, because that's like you said, I had no idea.
Why do these people care what happens to Muslims in China? Like, let's just be perfectly honest with themselves.
Yeah, because they don't care about what Muslims or, you know, what's happening to Muslims in Palestine. They certainly don't
give a shit. Yeah, but all of a sudden they have like their hearts grew three sizes. Yeah, their hearts grew three sizes for Uyghurs. Why is that? It's because this region is central to China's future economic developments and the ability for global South countries to develop themselves as well. And the United States, Australia, countries can't have that. So I know that I took a hell of a long time to get here and land this plane, but this is exactly why they're doing that.
Holy crap.
And okay, so for countries like in Africa that have gone anti-China, those countries, Kenya flirted with this and so did Uganda, but they got a hold of the anti-Chinese sentiment and they're continuing to do trade and business with China. Yeah. Zambia was sort of the canary in the coal mine. Zambia is what happens when you say, hey, you know what? Screw this. We're going to work with the West again. And Zambia's economy just went belly up. And these other countries are now these other countries, even Uganda, Yoweri Museveni, the president of Uganda, who was previously a little bit hawkish on China and very much partial to the United States.
Yeah.
Even he's sounding like an anti-imperialist nowadays, saying like, no, you know what? You come here and you just lecture us, and what you offer is for us to just hand over our business, our industries, everything that we have left. You want us just to hand it over to you, our ports, our ability to industrialize? You want us to cancel that out? Whereas China, India, and Russia are offering us the ability to industrialize at a low rate. Why would we ever do business with you again?
Right.
You know, so when you hear about China colonizing Africa, all that's happening is that the United States wants to colonize Africa, and they're upset that China is giving them a way out. They're giving them a better deal.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Holy crap, man. All right. I know you have a hard out at 8. I have so many questions. Dude, we have to do a follow-up show. Because I've talked about the Uyghur stuff quite a bit. My buddy Pat McFarlane, who works for the Libertarian Institute, did a whole documentary on it. Which is fantastic. And I'm sure you probably know everything that's going on in there. He, you know, even tied in the Epic Times and, you know, kind of that whole situation. Man.
Send me a link. Send me a link to that.
I will. Yeah. I'll send it over to you. But, you know, we kind of rail against, like, the, as my friend Conrail said here in the comments, even libertarians believe the genocide narrative. Tim Cass, libertarian. So I'm not sure how familiar you are with Tim Pohl, but I hate dishonest people, and he is dishonest as it gets. And on top of that, he's been one of the loudest China hawks that sucks in all the well-meaning libertarians and fucking points them right at China. It's like, no, you're carrying the neoconservative fucking water when you do shit like this, when you completely just hand over the narrative to right-wingers on China. And like I said, I'm socially right. I mean, I've only voted, you know, for Republicans and libertarians my entire life, but the North Star for me is like Ron Paul and Thomas Massie, because they're anti-interventionist, no sanctions.
You want to hear something? You want to hear something funny?
Good.
The older I get, I'm actually more of like a conservative communist, if that makes any sense to you at all.
Dude, that's exactly why we vibe so well, man. Nick, I've had Savvy Sabs on, and Misty Winston, if you're familiar with her, Carl Zaw. A bunch of more like left-wing anti-imperialist people. And, you know, I honestly enjoy talking to you guys just as much as I enjoy talking to the anti-imperialist libertarians. And like, I look up to you guys a lot, and you know, now you're definitely in that group as well. So go ahead and give your plugs, dude. Like I said, you have a hard out at 8. We have to do this again, man. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, listen, hey, I might have to take some pointers from you on just like, because my background is in print journalism, is writing. I don't like to stream. I tried streaming once. I fucking hated it the entire time that I was doing it. I don't like just parking and barking for extended periods of time unless somebody invites me on the show and asks me to. Yeah. doing video documentaries is daunting as hell because it's like I have to know everything before I even put pen to paper and get something produced. But hey, if you have the ability to, we should probably sit down and rap sometime just to talk about that, because I got to get something going. The fact that I used to assume the stuff that I know is like, it's common knowledge. Like everybody knows this shit.
No.
Like, who am I?
Yeah.
I'm slowly finding that out. I'm slowly finding out, oh wait, nobody knows this shit.
Yeah, dude. Honestly, you are an impressive wealth of knowledge when it comes to China. And I really admire that.
No, I appreciate that. Thank you. Yeah. Let's sit down and chat about it sometime. So yeah, I just started a Substack. It's called theculture.org. Haven't put much there yet, but I will be over the next couple of weeks. I've got quite a bit that I'm working on. That's you can find me my social is pretty much everywhere. Twitter is where I post the most, but you find me pretty much anywhere at Noble Q Ali. And I'm happy to come back whenever you want me to.
For sure, dude. Well, we'll definitely have to do a follow-up one on like China and also Israel Palestine, and then we're definitely one day do one about just lifting, because I enjoy those kind of talks as well. So,
yeah, man, anytime.
For sure. All right, everybody, thank you so much for listening. Make sure you go check out Q's stuff. I just absolutely love this chat. Make sure you go check out the episodes he did with Revolutionary Blackout Network, specifically the one they did, what was that, Sunday or Monday? I can't remember exactly when
that was. Monday, this past Monday.
Okay, yeah, absolutely fascinating show. You and Carl are both just wealths of knowledge on this stuff, and for anybody that's looking to learn more about China, I seriously couldn't recommend that show enough. And then like on top this and some of the other shows you done with them, I love it. So, dude, if you have anything else, we'll close her there.
Anytime, brother. All right, take it easy.
Thanks, everybody.
Your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.